Violence is their answer, the 1% is clear. If we organize for justice, they respond in right gear. 99 want health care for all and for all to go to school. Not poisons in our country driven by military rule.
Today from Colorado and Massachusetts, welcome to the Tim Danny Show here at Danny.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And today's show is something for which I had no idea. I had no idea about this court case called International Franchise Association versus City of Seattle. And you are going to be astounded by it because the corporations are using corporate personhood to go after living wages and raising minimum wages. And it is a ridiculous and frightening situation that you are not going to believe. And we have a gentleman by the name of Ron Fine, who is the legal director of Free Speech for People, as our guest. And you're going to want to stick around for that. We'll start that right after the break. But it's appalling, and it's a hint of what come if TPP passes. Speaking of the TPP, let's do some of the things in the news that aren't getting a whole lot of coverage. New York Times reported, and I think the Wall Street Journal also reported this to a degree. The New York Times certainly a little bit more thorough, but this trade pact that's going on, the TPP, the New York Times is reporting that the issues, non-financial and the non-trade issues, which are most of the TPP, the corporate protection issues, are really hurting the possibility of this bill passing. Now, of course, you know, they said that about the fast track too, and it passed. You know how they gave away all the bottles to congressmen for their pet projects. But right now, they're having some real problems. And for example, you know, Australia and New Zealand, according to the New York Times, are resisting American rules on access for pharmaceutical companies to their national health systems. You know, and you know, they want to maintain the sovereignty of their health systems. There's other things going on, too, such as Vietnam and Mexico and that little country of Brunei. You know, they're nowhere close to catching up to labor standards. And Canada doesn't want to open up its agricultural markets to competition. And there's even rumors that Canada is going to drop out of this whole TPP process. Absolutely amazing. And when it comes to politics, an amazing thing is that Malaysia, which is part of the 11 countries with the United States, you know, they do human trafficking and just, and human rights activists hate Malaysia. Well, the State Department, you know, in order to kind of facilitate the TPP, they upgraded their rating of Malaysia's efforts to combat human trafficking. And everybody who knows about such things are outraged because this is ridiculous. Within this TPP, American manufacturers, according to the New York Times, are issuing demands. Unions stay absolutely opposed. There's some pro-trade Democrats in the House of Representatives that are threatening to withdraw their support because of Obama's giving too many concessions to the pharmaceutical companies. You know, but still, despite all of this, a lot of the negotiators are saying that the talks they're confident it's going to pass. But let's not be too confident. I mean, just because Japan and the United States would like to put this together for various reasons, the other countries are in real problems. Now, these problems are exacerbated. They're increased because Canada has elections in October. And they have a very conservative prime minister, and the Canadian people don't like the TPP. And so he could lose the elections, and more liberal government officials could be elected in this regard. It's just nothing. It's nothing short of remarkable. Australia, remember we've talked about how the TPP would create like a super tribunal to litigate cases. You wouldn't even, it would be above the U.S. courts. And Australia doesn't like this. You know, Elizabeth Warren doesn't like it. She tried to make an amendment, and that was, it was shot down. It just goes on and on. You know, deforestation in Peru, the labor rights, as I mentioned. I mean, people are just lining up and taking shots at this thing. And so there's a real issue. The compromise that they had on the Fast Track Authority says that 4 months have to pass between the time that a final deal is reached, and they thought it would occur this week in Maui, where they're doing final negotiations, and the first chance Congress can even ratifying it. So if the deal, if they don't get a deal done this week over all these protests from various nations and entities, Congress can't get it before 2016. And woe to the congressman who votes for it in an election year. So it's just absolutely staggering what's going on with the TPP and the forces trying to push through such a frightening and unfair and un-American and unfree corporate protection bill. Absolutely amazing. Another fun story that just shows that maybe we are making a little progress in this world. Right now, there's two Democrats running for the Senate in Maryland. One is Chris Van Hollen, and the other one is Donna Edwards. And both of them, and I got this information from Huffington Post, but both of them are, you know, liberal Democrats, but they're competing on who is the biggest opponent of big money in politics. And they're making accusations back and forth. It's getting, you know, hot and heavy, and who stands for what. And it's fascinating that this issue can be an overriding issue within a Democratic primary, and, you know, it probably could become a major issue in 2016, because national opposition to money in politics is huge amongst Democrats, Republicans, and independents. But buried deep within the article, there was a paragraph that tells really what the public's attitudes are. And I shall read this paragraph. It says, the party, the Democratic Party, the party has found that email fundraising solicitations mentioning the billionaire Koch brothers or the Citizens United decision get grassroots Democrats to open their wallets unlike any other issues. Calls to overturn the court decision often get the loudest applause from presidential candidates, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton. And it just shows that campaign finance reform is a major issue, along with the TPP. And the people, you, listeners, are rising up, and they're actually saying enough of this. And so politicians are being forced to listen. All right, let's go on to some other things that are really interesting. This is something I did not know. And I know many of you listeners will say there's a lot that Tim doesn't know, and I have to take that in stride. But apparently, if you're a U.S. bank and a part of the Federal Reserve System, there's an entitlement program, and you get a risk-free, guaranteed 6% dividend to all the member banks. It doesn't matter whether it's a good year or a bad year, you get a 6% dividend. And to boot, if you have been a member of the Fed, somebody like J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, the 6% dividend, believe it or not, listeners, it's tax exempt because the statutes say if the bank shares and the Fed were acquired prior to March 1942, the bank doesn't have to pay corporate taxes on it. And J.P. Morgan and Citibank, you know, they go back to the 1800s in some cases. But anyway, just a staggering program where they get 6%. Well, Congress is saying this doesn't make sense. And so, especially with all the ridiculous things going on. And so what Congress wants to do is shrink the dividend from 6% to 1.5%. and the small banks that would not be affected by it. But just by doing that, it would raise $17 billion over 10 years. And what they want to do with that is put it towards the infrastructure. Now, I acknowledge that that's a drop in the bucket for what we need to do to help fix the infrastructure. But at least there's a thinking paradigm change. That, you know, something's going on here saying, well, you know, why are the bankers getting to gobble up all the money? We need to put it into infrastructure. Well, of course, you know, the American Bankers Association, they came, you know, the huge lobbyists, they wrote to Congress, and I quote from WallStreetOnParade.com, the American Bankers Association said, "We strongly urge you to oppose this proposal. As Senate Banking Chairman Richard Shelby has pointed out, there's absolutely no connection between the Federal Reserve System and the funding for the highway bill. Furthermore, during testimony before the Senate Banking Committee on July 16th, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen stated, I would say that this is a change to the law that could conceivably have unintended consequences, and I think it deserves serious thought and analysis." You know, I kind of agree with that. You know, I mean, you don't want to be financing government operations through the Federal Reserve. You know, yes, I think the dividend should be reduced. I would rather see the money put into something like reducing the interest rates on student loans, a financial function, or perhaps providing mortgage guarantee assistance or something to lower mortgage rates. I think there's better things to do, but what I do like is the fact that they're going after the banks and saying the 6% dividend, good years, bad years, especially the tax-free portion, is not right in today's banking environment. So interesting developments there. Another story that really disturbs me, you know, everybody knows what's going on in Greece. I've covered it, and I will continue to cover it. The situation goes on. I've talked about the failed economics of austerity, how it's based on a, believe it or not, a financial model out of Harvard University that had a spreadsheet error that was discovered by a graduate student at the University of Massachusetts, but yet still they use this model of austerity as being the cure-all for economic ills around the world, and it doesn't work. And so now in Puerto Rico, which is a financial basket case, it is the most ridiculous, one of the most ridiculous global situations. They are a commonwealth of the United States. They're unincorporated. We own them, essentially. It's a vassal state. They don't have full human rights or American rights. It's just a ridiculous relationship. They have very little autonomy over their own affairs. But anyway, there's $78 billion in debt, and the Puerto Rican president has said, truthfully, we can't pay it. Actually, the president, it's the governor. He says it's just not payable. Well, the hedge fund managers and the bondholders who are holding this $72 billion, you know, they're coming together, and they created an organization, and it's called For Puerto Rico, There Is a Better Way. And what they're saying is that Puerto Rico needs to drive through a bunch of austerity measures. In fact, they want to cut public education even more. They want to cut workers' rights protections to solve the crisis of debt and poverty in Puerto Rico. And so these hedge fund managers, they represent $5.2 billion of the debt. And they have three former economists for the International Monetary Fund. You know, they're telling the government to increase tax collection and then use the money to pay back the creditors, the hedge fund people, the bondholders, while at the same time they're increasing their tax collections. They want to severely slash public programs, especially education, and they want to step up privatizing public assets and industries in order to use the proceeds to pay back the billionaire bondholders. You know, and as far as the labor rights go, this report wanted to have structural reforms to regulations and worker protections. And they want to amend the local labor laws regarding overtime, vacation time, mandatory bonuses, and others, and make welfare benefits consistent with local labor market conditions. 13% of the people in Puerto Rico are unemployed, and 45% of them live below poverty line. You're not going to raise taxes and get more out of them. There are no jobs for Puerto Ricans to have in order to make it more lucrative than to be on public assistance. But yet, these are the kinds of solutions that the bankers always have. These are the kinds of solutions that drive Puerto Rico into the ground. These are the solutions that drive Greece into the ground. These are the solutions, the austerity programs, the cut, 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 and not allow government investment in public assets, including people. And these are the kind of things that these people are doing that are allowing them to siphon off the money, to buy public assets for pennies on the dollar, to raise our taxes, to increase the subsidies that are given to the corporations. And this is exactly the wrong economics for Greece, for Puerto Rico, and for us. And so these hedge fund managers have some brass ones to be going out and making these kind of recommendations. They sought to get rich. They issued the debt. They charged the high interest rate. They wanted to get rich. And now that it's come time for Puerto Rico essentially to pay the piper, these rich people that took the risk and were happy to take the interest, now they want to foreclose on Puerto Rico and turn it into a vassal Commonwealth of the United States. Horrible situation. Okay, when we come back, we're going to have a great conversation about this case of International Franchise Association versus City of Seattle. You got to hear this, and you're going to hear it here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
We want a decent job. No predatory lenders and banks that steal and rob. No drones in Pakistan. No assassination plan. No wars in Iraq, Iran, Congo, Afghanistan.
You preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today. CoffeePartyUSA.com.
It's against the law to be a pacifist here in the USA, 'cause the government says we're terrorists and takes our rights away. Yeah, the 99 are the enemy to Romney and Barack. Bill of Rights, civil liberties, they both are trying to sack.
You hear the music we're playing here on the Tim Danny Show. We like to feature socially aware music by independent artists across the country. So if you have music or you know a musician who would like us to feature their songs, contact us through Danahy.com. Send us an MP3 version or a link, a little bit about you and permission to use it on the show. And we'll listen. We'll try to feature it and we'll post your link for everyone to see. Music is a part of the Tim Danahy Show community. We'd love for you to be that part here at Danahy.com.
Yeah, the Dems and Republicans won't let us in debates. So the only ones at the podiums are corporate candidates.
Welcome back to the Tim Danny Show here at Danahy.com. And there's a case working its way through the court system that really seems to encompass all of my fears and perhaps your fears too. But it's about Citizens United, about corporate personhood, and even the ugly potential of living under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The case is simply titled International Franchise Association, Inc. versus City of Seattle. And you may not have heard of it. You probably haven't heard of it. But this case is where corporate rights clash with human rights, and its implications are staggering. And here to explain is Ron Fine. He's a legal director of Free Speech for People, and he's fighting for us. And Ron, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be on.
Well, Ron, this case. I haven't heard of it, and perhaps what we should do is kind of get a background on what's happening. And this is happening in more than the city of Seattle, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And as the living wage movement has spread across the country and gained traction in cities like Seattle and Los Angeles, we are seeing a well-coordinated and carefully strategized corporate response that's using constitutional litigation as a weapon to try to overturn these living wage ordinances. And the Seattle case is just one of several that we at FreeSpeechForPeople.org are monitoring and in some cases involved in. But it is a sign of a larger trend of corporate use of constitutional litigation to try and fight back against the expanding movement for increased minimum wages.
Well, Ron, whenever I hear the word coordinated attack, naturally two entities come to mind, and I just want to see if their thumbprints might be on it. One would be the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the other might be the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Who is backing this coordinated attacks on the living wage?
Well, I can tell you that the Chamber of Commerce is involved as a so-called friend of the court, or amicus curiae in Latin, in the Seattle case. The primary plaintiff in the Seattle case is called the International Franchise Association, which is basically the trade group for the franchising industry. And so that includes businesses like McDonald's and others that rely primarily on franchising. In the Los Angeles case, it's a living wage that's specific to the hotel industry, so it's the American Hotel and Lodging Association. And in both of these cases, these are national trade groups with heavy presences in Washington, D.C. They bring to the table in each of these cases a couple local businesses, so they can say they have a local plaintiff, but they are running this litigation out of their East Coast offices with lawyers who are specializing in this type of work.
Well, they're going after it, and obviously they're going after it to protect profits more than any other reason. I mean, rather than simply pay employees and incorporate that into the price, raise the prices or lower the profits, they choose to fight it in court. But what makes it kind of scary, and Ron, feel free to correct me, but what makes it kind of scary to me is that they're invoking a corporate personhood argument that I don't think we would have seen 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. The nature of this debate is one that, let me be clear, there are positions on both sides of the issue of whether to raise the minimum wage that can be made in good faith in terms of how high it should be set to benefit workers without indirectly or inadvertently harming the economy. But what happens is once you get into the political debate process, once you're before the city council or the people's elected representatives, whoever they may be, and the city council votes to increase the minimum wage, there are a few different reactions that some business owners might have. Some of them, and I guess I should say also, some business owners support increasing the minimum wage in the belief that it will help the economy more broadly. But even those who oppose an increase to the minimum wage, many of them will, after losing that debate in the political process, will accept the results of the Democratic deliberation and will adjust their business plans accordingly to pay the higher minimum wage. But what we're seeing are these national trade organizations coming in with much larger goals in mind. They're not primarily concerned about what happens in Seattle or in LA hotels. They're worried about whether they can use these cases as an opportunity to stop the national living wage movement in its tracks. And I'll give you just one example of that I think is quite striking. There's a very well-known, very highly respected Supreme Court specialist named Paul Clements, who is a well-known corporatist advocate. He's been before the Supreme Court many times, and he's widely considered to be one of the best in the business. And Paul Clements came to Seattle to argue in a local courtroom in Seattle against the law that was increasing the minimum wage in Seattle. Now, when companies are hiring a lawyer like Paul Clements, they are paying through the roof for his services, and they're not doing it just because they think he can help them win in Seattle. They're setting up that case to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And I think that we should look at this in the context of Citizens United and the overall recent history of corporations claiming constitutional rights that at the time of our founding and at the time of the post-Civil War Reconstruction, when some of the most important amendments to the Constitution were passed, were understood as rights of actual people and not of corporations.
Well, I look at this, Ron, and I notice that, you know, it is in the city of Seattle, and it is now at the United States, or the your friend of the court brief is at the United States Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit. And, I'm no lawyer, but typically isn't the Court of Appeals Ninth Circuit typically friendly to people, if I can put it that way? And so it really, it's their intent to take it to the Supreme Court to establish a precedent, isn't it?
Yes, I think they're planning to go all the way to the Supreme Court. They're hoping that they wouldn't be paying Paul Clements for any purpose other than going to the Supreme Court. And let me also give credit to the judge in Seattle who saw through the arguments that the International Franchise Association was making, and we can talk in detail about those later, but the judge in Seattle rejected the claims and denied their request for a preliminary injunction which would block the law, and that's why they're before the Ninth Circuit. And as long as we can keep persuading judges of good sense not to accept these arguments, we may not need to go to the Supreme Court. But I think when I said this is a well-coordinated and well-funded movement, the other side is playing multidimensional chess and is planning to use whatever cases it can find. If it's the one in Seattle, they'll use that. If it's the one in Los Angeles, they'll use that. Once they get a case that they think is a favorable vehicle to take to the Supreme Court, I think they would be quite happy to try and get a Supreme Court ruling on this type of issue.
Well, Ron, could we go into just a little bit what their arguments are? Because it's the 14th Amendment. It seems to be the amendment in play that they're using in their defense. And could you perhaps talk about just briefly about the 14th Amendment and what the International Franchise Association is saying, how it applies to them, and how it should protect them from minimum wage?
Absolutely. The 14th Amendment was passed a couple of years after the Civil War. The amendment that came before it, the 13th Amendment, abolished slavery. But what happened was in the process of what they call Reconstruction, when the United States was basically trying to rebuild the South, they realized that it was not so simple as just abolishing slavery. And so the 14th Amendment was designed to provide equal citizenship to the freed slaves, and also looking forward to other issues of equality. And the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause was part of the recent ruling about same-sex marriage. But unfortunately, what happened was, a few years after the 14th Amendment was passed, the railroad corporations of the time began to argue that when the Equal Protection Clause, which I can quote for you, it says that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And the railroad corporations began attacking various state laws, usually they were tax laws, as violating the Equal Protection Clause. And the Supreme Court, without any analysis or discussion, just assumed that corporations count as persons under the 14th Amendment. And that began an era that lasted for several decades that lawyers call the Lochner era. And it's named that after the famous case Lochner versus New York, in which the Supreme Court used the 14th Amendment and its view of laissez-faire economics to strike down wage and hour laws. We're actually at the cutting edge of it. I mean, maximum work weeks and other laws designed to protect workers in general, special laws protecting female workers or child labor. And the Supreme Court would strike these down left and right for several decades. And finally, there was some popular pushback around the time of the New Deal. And in 1937, the Supreme Court stepped back from the brink and said in a case, as it happens, involving the state of Washington and its minimum wage law, basically said, we're not going to interpret the 14th Amendment as blocking these laws anymore. This is a matter for democratic debate. If the people want to raise their minimum wage, let them do so. And if it has negative economic effects, they'll figure that out and they can adjust it as needed. And from that point until fairly recently, the courts stepped back from economic issues and wouldn't engage in that type of debate. So it's not enough anymore, or at least it in theory isn't enough anymore, for business owners or corporate lawyers to come into court and simply say the minimum wage will be harmful to profits. They have to come up with a little something more than that. They have to show that the law is irrational. And what's happening is we're seeing an increased percentage of these types of arguments. Now, to be clear, they haven't yet succeeded very widely, but we're seeing them being brought with greater tenacity and greater acuity. And I think the example I gave of hiring one of the best-known corporate Supreme Court specialists in the country to argue a case from the beginning is an indication that they're upping the game, and they're going to use the Equal Protection Clause, and also an issue in the Seattle case, believe it or not, is the First Amendment. They're claiming that the way the law is written actually violates the freedom of speech of the franchising industry, and using whatever tools they can find to try and push back against this movement to increase the minimum wage.
Well, something that I was quite startled, Ron, when looking at the summary of your brief. Honestly, I did not get into the 25 pages, but and I think you'll forgive me for that. At least I hope you will. But I was what I saw in the summary was that they were claiming that animus, which I presume is simply the Latin root for animosity, that the cities had animosity towards the corporations and animosity towards the International Franchise Association. And that's blatantly untrue, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is an example of this corporate constitutional rights advocacy exploiting to its own ends the development of individual rights jurisprudence. So animus is a twist in the Equal Protection Clause law that basically says that if there's a law that's motivated by dislike or prejudice against a particular group, then the court will look at that law a lot more closely, even if it's a purely economic law. And some examples of that, there's cases from the 1970s against about laws that were based on basically discriminating against hippies in housing. There's cases involving discrimination against undocumented immigrants. And most recently, we've seen this animus line of cases be the fountainhead for the same-sex marriage equality litigation, basically arguing that if a law is based on nothing more than animus against gay or lesbian people, then it has to have a closer judicial review, certainly, than any other law. And so what's happening is that many of these corporate advocates they're faced with the fact that since 1937, the standard Supreme Court analysis for economic laws is supposed to be very deferential. And so what they're doing is they're seizing on this animus and arguing that the people have a hostility to business corporations. Now, what's absurd about this is that the Supreme Court has long said that courts should intervene to strike down laws when there's what they call in famous words discrete and insular minorities, meaning a group that is politically powerless, that can't protect itself through the democratic process. But business corporations are the opposite of that. They're certainly capable of taking care of themselves in the political process. Many, including we at freespeechforpeople.org, would say they're too effective at taking care of themselves in the political process. But when they do lose in the political process and a law is passed against their objections, there's no role for a court to come in and strike down the law based on some theory that it's motivated by dislike.
Well, I tell you, Ron, I want to follow up on this. I need to break for a quick commercial, and when we come back, we're going to pursue this. This case is huge, and it's now coming to my attention, and we need to talk about it a little bit more. We're talking with Ron Fine, and he's the legal director of Free Speech for People, and you're listening to him here on the Tim Danahy Show. We'll be right back.
Can only serve to illuminate the hundreds of lives of the 1%, and that might change the state.
Teddy Roosevelt said, of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth. This is why antitrust law and competition is essential to America's economic health. This is why the Organization for Competitive Markets works to reclaim competition for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across America. We believe our duty is to advocate a just role for government in the agricultural economy, an enforcer of rules necessary for markets that are fair, honest, and accessible. The Organization for Competitive Markets. Learn more at competitivemarkets.com.
Your democracy takes integrity, and if you want it back.
Welcome to this episode of the Tim Danahy Show's American History Minutes. In 1995, when the U.S. Senate was considering the United States as part of the World Trade Organization, Ralph Nader challenged every member of Congress to read the entire treaty and answer 10 simple questions in public. Nader asked because he saw no evidence that any congressman even read what was in the bill that would represent the greatest surrender of local, state, and national sovereignty in United States history. Of all the members of Congress, only Senator Hank Brown of Colorado had the fortitude to accept Nader's challenge. He read the World Trade Agreement, sat down in front of an audience and cameras, and correctly answered 12 questions. His response to actually reading the treaty? He said he believed in free trade, but he was stunned how the World Trade Organization was a threat to national sovereignty. No other member of Congress showed evidence of reading the bill, and Senator Brown went to his fellow senators and tried to tell them the trade agreement was bad for America. However, no one changed their vote. The U.S. became part of the World Trade Organization, and all our legislation that affects business and consumers is subjugated to the final authority of the World Trade Organization. The world's greatest deliberative body didn't even read the bill that surrendered our ability to freely make future laws. This American History Minute is brought to you by The Tim Danahy Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show, follow us on Twitter at hashtag Tim Danahy Show, and listen to us at Danahy.com.
Romney and Barack. So when it's time to vote this year, if you're not sitting in some jail.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're talking about a case which I've never heard. International Franchise Association versus City of Seattle, and there's a similar case in Los Angeles. And we're talking with Ron Fine, who is the legal director of Free Speech for People, and how corporations, in this case, are fighting minimum wage laws in a couple of California cities, and they're using corporate personhood as a basis for it, and they are also claiming that these laws are evidence of animus, of animosity towards corporations by the municipalities passing the laws. And, Ron, I look at this and, you know, by that basis, then, all the pro-corporate legislation that is passed, and I look at urban renewal districts, tax incentive, tax abatements, various breaks that are given to corporations by the same municipalities, presumably in Seattle and Los Angeles, that would be the evidence of lack of animus towards a corporation. And furthermore, one would think that using the corporation's own argument, in this case, citizens could complain that giving corporate favoritism is animus to people. I'm not a lawyer, but you see where I'm going with this. This is really opening up a hornet's nest.
Yeah, and I think it just points out the absurdity of the corporate argument. And the reality is that many people in I'm sure both of these cities believe that the cities are already bending over backwards to accommodate some of these business corporations as is, and certainly not motivated by hatred for them. You obviously will find, you know, stray remarks by one person or another that could be interpreted in such a way as to indicate some type of hostility. But the key point is that corporations are not a politically powerless entity that is deserving of special judicial protection. The Equal Protection Clause was initially passed, as I said, to protect the freed slaves. Now, obviously, it's not limited to just protecting African Americans. It protects any group of people that are, or individuals even, who are being treated unequally for an improper reason. And so the Equal Protection Clause has been the foundation for cases involving discrimination against women, against, obviously, in there's recent cases with same-sex marriage, discrimination against gays and lesbians. And there will be new types of minorities or other groups of people that we may not even be aware of at this point right now that will properly come within the protection of the Equal Protection Clause in the future. But these will be groups that are disfavored by the majority, that are looked down upon or somehow isolated politically in a way that is absurd to say of the International Franchise Association or the American Hotel and Lodging Association. These are politically powerful trade groups with substantial connections. They're very effective in Washington, D.C. They're somewhat less effective in local city governments, and that's why they're trying to take this fight to the judiciary.
Well, Ron, you mentioned in your amicus brief that that actually that the minimum wage or living wage laws are actually supporting the principles of the 14th Amendment. They're not contrary to the principles as the corporations contend. And you mentioned that such a minorities of various sorts, you cite Indians, Native Americans, African Americans, Asian Pacifics, and Hispanic, typically are the ones who are making less than a living wage, and that the 14th Amendment would discourage that. In reality, is that a logical argument within that? I mean, to see that you're trying to defend the poor, not exploit them.
Absolutely. And in my research, in looking at the original history of the 14th Amendment and why Congress passed it in the first place, I paged through a document from the 1860s known as the Report of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction. And it's about 800 pages of transcripts of testimony by various witnesses who had come from the South, black, white, government, civilian, many military witnesses, because at that time the Union Army was administering large parts of the South. And Congress was intently interested in a number of questions about what was going on in the South. And one of the questions, certainly not the only one, but one of the questions that the congressman kept asking about over and over again, and by the way, these were not sort of backbencher congressmen, not the, you know, sort of the 1860s equivalent of the loudmouth yahoos that we sometimes have today who are just trying to get on C-SPAN. These were like the Senate floor men of the 14th Amendment. These were influential and important congressmen. And one of the questions that they kept asking over and over again was, now that the slaves have been freed, how is the economy working for them? And in particular, they asked over and over again whether the freedmen could earn fair living wages. And that's an exact quote that appears several times. Either they ask about freedmen earn fair living wages, can they earn fair wages, can they earn living wages, and they made it very clear through the testimony that when they said fair wages, what they meant was a wage adequate for a worker, at that time it was, you know, generally a man, to support his family. And that was of cardinal importance to the Congress that passed the 14th Amendment. Now, they didn't write a requirement for a living wage into the 14th Amendment, but certainly part of the spirit and purpose of the 14th Amendment was to enable conditions of economic equality for the freedmen who would be working for the first time under free labor rather than slave labor. And given the importance to the 14th Amendment's authors of fair living wages, I think it's reasonable to say that if the Equal Protection Clause has anything at all to say about a minimum wage law, and maybe you could argue that the Equal Protection Clause is completely irrelevant to this entire discussion, but if it has anything at all to say about a minimum wage law, then the Equal Protection Clause's own history demonstrates a concern for fair living wages. And then if you transport forward in time and you say, who are the people or what entities are the descendants, so to speak, of the freedmen whose living wage Congress was concerned about, I would say that it would probably be the workers who are currently struggling to earn a living wage. And in Seattle's preparation for its living wage ordinance, they found that 70% of the city's American Indian and Alaska Native workers were earning less than the new minimum wage. And about half of its Hispanic workers, 43% of its African American workers, and about 2 out of 5 of the Asian Pacific Islander workers in Seattle are earning less than the new minimum wage. So I think those people have a much better claim to being the beneficiaries of the Equal Protection Clause than the International Franchising Association and its members like McDonald's, who are not standing in the same position as the newly freed slaves of the late 1860s.
Ron, you know, I look at this case, I look at the potential case against Senator Menendez in New Jersey, all of these cases just kind of illustrating the absurdity of Citizens United and the power of money in politics and corporate personhood. I feel comfortable that there will be a rational ruling in the Ninth Circuit, but here we have a Supreme Court with you know, with Scalia and Alito and Thomas on it. And if it got to the Supreme Court, a case like this, can you speculate or should you speculate on what would happen?
It's always dangerous to speculate about what the Supreme Court would do. And that's particularly because some of the justices will surprise you every now and then. Chief Justice Roberts, for example, has taken some surprising positions this past year. Kennedy is often a swing vote. And every now and then you'll be completely shocked by Scalia or Thomas, less often Alito, taking a position that you would not expect them to take. It does get to the Supreme Court, and of course I hope it won't. I think what you'll see is a war within what you might call the conservative branch of justices, with several of them willing to go all the way to try and find a constitutional basis to strike down the living wage law, and one or two saner ones maybe being sympathetic to what the other ones are saying but not wanting to go as far. And the question will be, how do those one or two justices shake out? Do they end up taking over the whole opinion? Do they end up siding with the four so-called liberal justices? And so I'm unable at this point to give an exact prediction, but I have a feeling that if it got to the Supreme Court, it would rest on the shoulders of one justice, whether that be Roberts or Kennedy is hard to say. And so much of what might come out of that might be, for example, with Roberts, they often say it's how he sees his place in history. Kennedy might view this case from the perspective of animus and the cases for gay and lesbian rights, which he's behind. And it's a little too hard to predict. There's a saying that sometimes a judicial decision depends more than anything else on what the judge had for breakfast that day.
Well, you know, Kennedy wrote the legal opinion, I think, on Citizens United, or it was perhaps McCutcheon, about money in politics. And I wonder if at some point there will be some sort of legal atonement for his error, and perhaps these are the kind of cases that can be brought up. One other question I want to ask on this, you know, these corporations, the International Franchise Association, they're pursuing this and trying to set a precedent that says that municipalities are hostile. And what they are trying to do is what's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, too, where if a anti-corporate profit legislation is passed, we have to reimburse the corporations for what happens. If the minimum wage were passed after the approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the city of Seattle would have to pay the corporations who lost. So this is like a snapshot of what the Trans-Pacific Partnership could be. But are there any unintended consequences for the corporations taking this path?
That's a really interesting question. I think that, like you say, the so-called investor state provisions of some of these trade treaties, like the TPP, and these constitutional claims do share in common this idea of trying to appeal to a higher outside body to strike down laws that the corporations find inconvenient. By the same token, I think it's really interesting that there's a tendency for these businesses to hide behind these trade groups, meaning that the plaintiff is International Franchise Association, which most Americans have never heard of, rather than, let's say, McDonald's, which is one of its most important members and whose executives generally hold a seat on its board. And I think that many of these corporations are concerned about their public image and are much happier for the litigation to be managed by a trade group rather than the company itself. And we see the same thing with a lot of political spending and efforts to fund, you know, climate denial think tanks, that many of the corporations are trying to balance a strategy of trying to undermine these laws while also trying to keep their fingerprints off it to some extent. And I think that of the many ways that we can respond to these, you know, one obviously is in the courts. Another is to support a constitutional amendment. And if you go to freespeechforpeople.org, you can see that there is one in the Senate. There are two, actually. One to overturn Citizens United in terms of money being spent in elections, but the other one to overturn the entire doctrine of corporate constitutional rights. And so people can get involved in helping get their local community to pass a resolution endorsing one or both of these amendments. But the other thing is to shine a spotlight on who's behind the International Franchise Association and who's behind all of these trade groups, which are, you know, general organizations run out of Washington, D.C., with lawyers in D.C. or New York, and it's hard to find a local face of it for people who are living in Seattle or L.A., but people in those cities or anywhere in the country can shine a light on who's really funding this litigation and who is it that's claiming that the Equal Protection Clause, which has been, on the one hand, such an amazing vehicle for expanding marriage equality and providing the foundation for integration of schools, and yet on the other hand has been such a disappointment when it comes to things like mass incarceration and other aspects related to equality in education, that it's just a travesty that this is being used now to attack minimum wage laws.
At the very least, Ron, one would think, you know, I always stress that we vote every day, and we vote every day by where we shop. And at the end of every day, these corporations are living or dying by where we choose to spend our money, where we vote to support or avoid the principles that different corporations espouse. So hopefully people can remember that whenever these kind of issues arise. And, of course, I hope people would get involved with organizations like Free Speech for People. Ron, I'm going to ask one more thing, if you could. Just talk a little bit about Free Speech for People, how people can find out more about it, websites, and so forth, please.
Yeah, thank you. So the history of the organization is we were founded on the very afternoon of the Citizens United decision in January of 2010. And at our website, which is freespeechforpeople.org, and that's the word for, not the numeral for, you can find out about the Constitutional Amendment campaign, our legal advocacy, and ways that that people can take action in their local communities. There's an organizer's toolkit with videos and other resources, and you can join our mailing list and keep track of everything that's going on in these areas of wealthy and corporate interests trying to dominate our political and judicial systems.
Well, Ron, you know, I know it's wrong for a person to feel pride in themselves, and I'm not going to illustrate that for you, but I'm going to say I'm proud of you for fighting what you're doing, and also the people at freespeechforpeople.org fighting these issues. I am so glad that you're involved with this, and I'm hoping that we can raise awareness and continue to advance the cause, really, of human rights in this country and around the world. Thank you so much for coming on the Tim Danny Show. It's just been such a privilege.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me on.
We'll try it again. Thank you.
Don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail. Don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail.